Good morning. May it please the court, Charles Kaiser. I'm here on behalf of the teacher appellant, Scott Hansen. First of all, I'd like to compliment the court. This is a beautiful courtroom and much better than the old state judicial building because the ceiling's lower, so hopefully the acoustics will be a little bit better. I thought in the old court it was a little hard sometimes to hear, and plus it's better to be closer to the bench. I think it's just easier. Having said that, the case is up here, as the court knows, on two separate appeals. One is a judicial review of the decision of the Board of Education, and the second dismissal case against Mr. Hansen to terminate his employment. So that's governed by the statute 2263-302. And then the other case that's up here is an appeal of a district court decision dismissing Mr. Hansen's 106A2 claim to have the district court order the Board of Education to act on the first dismissal case, in which, as the court knows, the administrative law judge recommended Mr. Hansen's retention. So I thought, and you know, we're set for an hour, but I certainly don't have anywhere near an hour's worth of prepared argument, and I'm sure this won't break the court's heart if I don't take my full half an hour. I want to start my argument by posing a hypothetical to the court. Let's just change the fact pattern around a little bit. Say Mr. Boasberg was in a vehicle collision with Mr. Hansen, Mr. Superintendent Boasberg. Mr. Hansen brought a damages action in district court. His complaint alleged that the superintendent was going too fast, and that's why the superintendent struck Mr. Hansen's vehicle. The morning of trial in the district court case, Mr. Hansen's lawyer shows up and said, well, you know, I've been thinking about it. I looked at the car again, I looked at the photos, and I think, you know, maybe Superintendent Boasberg didn't really pay proper attention to fixing his brakes. So I want to try this case not only on the theory alleged in the complaint that the superintendent was going too fast, but also on this new theory that I've just thought of, that the brakes were fixed improperly. So, Your Honor, either I want to dismiss without prejudice, get a continuance, or proceed on this new theory this morning. The district court says, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you do that. You can go forward today, or I'm going to dismiss with prejudice. District court dismisses with prejudice. That case comes up here on a direct appeal, and then a second lawsuit gets filed by Mr. Hansen alleging that the superintendent was going too fast and didn't properly fix his brakes. I would respectfully submit to the court that second lawsuit's not going to get a lot of traction. And I would respectfully submit to the court that's just about the fact pattern that we have in this case. And really, that's the gist of what I'm saying. I do just have a couple other things I'd like to say to this court, okay? And please hear me out on this. You know, we at the teachers union, and I as an attorney for the teachers union, get more special education teachers as clients than any other kind of teacher for the various cases. And you know, Mr. Hansen was under the gun for—
Is this in the record, counsel?
No, this is argument, Your Honor. Mr. Hansen was under the gun for a long time as a special education teacher. That is in the record. You know, being a special education teacher, you know, you work with the students. That's challenging, but it's rewarding too. You also have an amazing amount of paperwork that you have to do. You can have overzealous parents and hypervigilant parents, which is understandable. And certainly it is in the record, Your Honor, that Mr. Hansen was subject to an endless stream of accusations by the district of extremely serious conduct, which the district really didn't put very much evidence on. You know, the administrative law judge found that Mr. Hansen was burnt out at the end of his time at the district. While we respectfully disagree with that finding, that's the record as it sits to the court today. That is in the record. Out of all the things that the district charged him with, that's the one thing in a couple of specific incidents that the administrative law judge did find that Mr. Hansen did wrong on the second dismissal case. You know, and the district argues in its brief, and it seems like its primary argument is that because it prevailed on the second go-around, therefore Mr. Hansen doesn't have a basis to get the case reversed because the school board's failure to comply with the statutory requirement that it act on the first dismissal case somehow just vanishes. And
well, Mr. Kaiser, let me ask you some questions if I can about that. The school district's argument appears to hinge upon whether it had the ability and the authority to withdraw the charges.
Right.
And your position is it did not.
Well, my position is it did not, Your Honor. I mean, there's nothing in the statute that allows it to do that. The two cases it cites were cases where there was no jurisdiction in the first set of charges. I think one, the school district acted under the wrong statute, and I can't remember what the facts are, the second one, but they were both lack of jurisdiction, and it's well known as a matter of res judicata law that if the court in the first case doesn't have jurisdiction, the whatever proceedings happen in the first case don't serve as a bar.
So is that the first issue we have to decide, whether or not there was in fact a withdrawal or whether the district could withdraw the case?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that. That's a central issue in this case.
So let's assume that the ALJ was wrong. What do we do with that?
The ALJ was wrong saying the district could not withdraw.
Yes.
Well then, Your Honor, I think the analogy I would make is it's akin to a double jeopardy situation. I mean, the analogy I would make to the court is somebody goes to trial in a criminal case. On round one, the jury's impaneled, they're acquitted. They're charged again for the same transaction in the second case. They raise a double jeopardy defense. The trial court denies it. On the second go-round, they're convicted. I would respectfully submit that the conviction on the second go-round doesn't cure the double jeopardy violation.
Well, let's explore that a little bit, because it seems to me that if, regardless of whether the ALJ was wrong, let's assume the ALJ was wrong in saying you can't withdraw your claims, you can't proceed. Nonetheless, there was an avenue for appeal from that decision, was there not?
No. I mean, the only remedy, the case law is, Your Honor, well, first of all, at least for purposes of appeal, the case law is, and I cited the case, you can't appeal to this court until there's a final judgment by the board. That's what the statute says.
So my point is, they could have gotten an order from the Board of Education and then appealed from that determination and asserted that the ALJ erred in his determination that they couldn't withdraw the claims.
That actually raises an interesting question, Your Honor. There is no provision in TECDA 2263.302 that even provides for the parties to file something with the board saying we disagree with what the administrative law judge did. Like under the APA, in a licensing case, you have to file exceptions to get the board, whatever the licensing board is, to make a final decision. In this case, the case automatically goes to the board, so the district didn't even have to appeal it. All they had to do was give the decision to the board. In fact, the statute's silent on how it happens, but the board's required to act. So,
can I explore that a little bit, Counselor? I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No.
On that point, if the district disagreed with the ALJ, as was hypothesized, what would be the statutory procedure, or what's outlined in the statute, which would allow the district to go to the board and raise the issue that they disagreed with the ALJ? Because the way I read the statute, after the ALJ issues a recommendation of retention or dismissal, the board has to do one of those three things, either dismiss, retain, or put the teacher on probation. And if it disagrees with the ALJ's recommendation of retention, and wants to do something different, the board has to still rely on the factual findings of the ALJ. In this case, because there was no evidence presented, there weren't a lot of factual findings. So given this posture, how could the district have challenged the ALJ's decision before the board? I don't see it in the statute.
That's a great question, Your Honor. The statute does say when it goes to the board, dismiss, retain, or retain on probation, but I think there's a case, one of the many cases under TECDA, that says the board had authority to issue a remand for further factual findings. So if the administrative law judge's initial rulings were just wrong and abuse of discretion, I would suggest that the board would have that inherent authority. And there's case law, so I'm sure Your Honor's familiar with, there's a penumbra of authority that administrative boards have to enforce their jurisdiction and to enforce their powers. So I would say, if there was a valid basis to reverse the ALJ's decision to dismiss, to not grant dismissal without prejudice, that would be in the board's authority, and that's the position that Mr. Hansen's taken in the briefs. So I do think they have that authority. I would suggest that under these facts, it would have been abuse of authority for the board to reverse the ALJ on the first go-round, but I don't question their authority to do that.
Well, even if it didn't have authority to do that, the remedy then would be to come to this court and ask this court to review the determination by the ALJ. And clearly, we have authority based on the statute to remand to the ALJ, do we not?
Well, but we can't get to this court until there's a board decision.
Right. I'm hypothesizing that you get an order from the board saying, regardless of what we did, what the ALJ found, we're still going to dismiss the teacher.
Right.
Then you could come up here and seek review not only of that decision, but of anything the ALJ did that you think was erroneous.
Right. And I tried to do that, whether mistakenly or not, by going to the district court and asking the district court to order the board to act under 106A2. So turning to the second case, which I don't have a lot to add to what's in the briefs, but in the absence of a remedy to go to this court until the board acted, and I think that's what Fry says, is then the teacher's supposed to go to the district court under 106A2. So we try to posture the case so we get a final decision from the board on the first go-around, but the district court declined, and of course we respectfully disagree with that. But I would suggest that, I mean, Mr. Hansen shouldn't have had to do that at all. The 106A2 should have been unnecessary. The board should have followed the statutory requirement and acted within 20 days, or we could give them a couple of weeks. You know, wouldn't have objected if 8:30 to make or issue a final decision. I don't think there's any latitude in the statute that allows the board to do anything other than and take some kind of action on the ALJ decision, either, you know, whatever that action is.
Let me ask you, while we're talking about the mandamus case, the errors that you brought up to us are whether the court erred in requiring Mr. Hansen to exhaust his administrative remedies and whether it erred in determining that it lacked subject matter jurisdiction once you commenced the appeal of the second proceeding. What the relief that I see you asking for in your brief is simply a remand to the district court.
Right.
Although you want something, anything broader than that? Are you asking us to make a decision on the mandamus issue?
Well, it depends. I guess it depends on how this court writes the opinion. I mean, the 106A2 case that's up here potentially could be moot depending on how the court rules on the judicial review case. And I understand that's, I think, what Judge, I would speculate, that that's what Judge Martinez was thinking. I mean, if this court rules that the ALJ was wrong to even commence the second proceedings under one of the reasons that I've given, I mean, until the board acted, then to some extent that moots out the 106A2, I mean, depending on how you rule.
Well, let me ask you this then. There's a four-prong test for claim preclusion. And the one thing that it appears the district pursued in before the ALJ was that there was no final judgment.
Right, which was, you know, a catch-22. You know, there was no final judgment because the board refused to act because the district management never gave the first decision to the board to act on. So that's where we were going to the ALJ. I mean, there would have been. And well, there was no remedy available to Mr. Hansen. So, you know, my position at that point is the district court should have ruled and ordered the board to act. We weren't asking district court to do anything other than tell the board to make a decision on the first go around. And so it's just, I mean, the district court said we should have exhausted our administrative remedies, but what we were looking for from the district court was the administrative. We were asking the district court to tell the board to give us an administrative remedy.
Can I ask you a question about your claim preclusion theory? Because of the so-called catch-22 that you described, you're relying on this practical finality theory. And I have a question. If we were to agree with your arguments in the mandamus matter, and you were to get a mandamus from the trial court directing the district to issue an order, you would have finality. And wouldn't that render moot the argument about whether we should apply this theory of practical finality in the first time to a claim preclusion case?
And again, Your Honor, what I would turn to is my double jeopardy analogy. I would respectfully submit if there's error, which there, I mean, with all due respect, obviously they violated the statute, then it's like trying somebody a second time in a criminal case. I don't know that that really moots out the violation and my analogy.
Well, no, I'm saying it would move the question of whether practical finality theory should apply to a claim preclusion case, because we would have actual finality in that scenario.
Well, but wouldn't there only be actual finality when the well, okay, I understand your question now. I mean, a year after the fact, I mean, they had, the Supreme Court says an opportunity to appeal can trigger the practical finality. I mean, I guess what I'm asking for, the home run decision would be, you know, at this point, there was practical finality as of the second go around because the district administrations essentially prevented the board from ruling. So, I mean, what I'm saying, I mean, I guess my primary argument is at this point, the administrative law judge should have just said it's res judicata. They had their bite of the apple, and the case is over.
So on that theory, which order should have, which decision should have preclusive effect? The ALJ's first recommendation under your claim preclusion theory?
On a practical finality theory, yeah, that's my main argument.
So but the ALJ issues a recommendation, correct? It's
right.
Not the final decision maker?
Right.
Did you find any case in which claim preclusion or issue preclusion was applied to a decision to a recommendation rather than to an order by the final decision maker?
No. I mean, in fact, there's case law from this court that says it's not a final decision for appellate purposes until there's a board decision. So the answer to your question is no, Your Honor, I don't. But this is, I mean, a unique situation. I mean, and obviously it's not final for purposes of appeal, but under a practical finality rule, what else could possibly happen other than the ALJ ruled and it just sits there? So that I would suggest that that's the basis for the practical finality rule. I mean, it's clearly not final in the traditional sense.
There are other prongs to the claim preclusion issue, three others. And the way I read your brief is you're asserting that those can be decided as a matter of law?
Yes.
Well, isn't there some dispute about whether there was, before the ALJ, now I'm talking about, the other, at least one or two of the other prongs? I mean, I think we've got a question of, was there an encompassing of the same subject matter? Are those issues of fact or are those issues of law?
Your Honor, I would submit that they're issues of law. I cited the court, the Tenth Circuit case, one employment relationship is one transaction. There's obviously identity of the parties. So my position is those are matters of law, not fact. And to the extent that they're issues of fact, I mean, could have been brought, I mean, the district, when it showed up the morning of the first hearing and said, well, we found some new stuff to use against Mr. Hansen, I mean, they didn't give any real explanation as to why they waited till the morning of trial or why they couldn't have discovered all this stuff.
I guess that's my question. I mean, the assertion that you made was you could have brought these things in this proceeding, in the first proceeding.
Right.
And they said they couldn't. And so my question is, do we have a factual record on which we can make that determination?
Yeah, I mean, my position is we do. It's the absence of a factual record. It's the absence of any explanation. Well, they said they just found out about them, but they didn't really explain why they just found out about them. And if the court reads the second opinion, it's most of the same witnesses and all the same stuff, you know, that they had. I mean, for example, they had one of their administrators go through Mr. Hansen's IEPs and say how terrible they were, but that happened before the dismissal proceeding even commenced, and Mr. Hansen was on leave. I mean, he was on leave, terminal leave, as of August of 2010. By the time we get to court, the first time it's November of 2011, so they had a year. I mean, they waited until March of 2011 to even institute the first dismissal case. So I would say if there's any factual dispute, or if there's a factual issue, it was incumbent on management to show the administrative law judge on the first go-around that there is some reason, you know, there's some fact here. You know, and I understand, you know, under certain circumstances, you know, and the law encompasses this, you know, even if it's the same transaction, there's times when you can relitigate if it's really something that you couldn't have known until after the first case was commenced, or even after the first case is over, because there's remedies for relief from judgment. I mean, let's say a district terminates a teacher for unsatisfactory performance, it loses, and then a year later it discovers that some student comes forward that they have no way to know about and says the teacher did some terrible thing. I can think of examples. Then, you know, under that circumstance, they could start over and initiate a new dismissal. If it was something that they couldn't have known upon the exercise of reasonable diligence, but we didn't hear any of that. We haven't heard any of that up to now. I mean, they're just saying, well, we found some new stuff and we want to add it. But that was the substance of it. So I know, Your Honor, my position is there is no factual dispute.
Can I return to one question to make sure I totally understood your answer? If in this scenario, in this case, after the first hearing, when the ALJ denied the request to dismiss the case, the DPS request to dismiss the case and went on to make findings and issue a recommendation that the teacher be retained, in that scenario, it's your view that DPS could have gone to the board and the board would not have been required to find the teacher to be retained. Instead, the board could have sent it back to the ALJ for further hearings if the board disagreed with the ALJ's decision not to continue or not to dismiss the first charges?
The board would have had the power to send it back. I mean, if the board had sent it back, eventually I would have been back up here anyway, because there was no reason for
your point is, on the record that the ALJ made, based on his recommendation, the board would not have been compelled to order the teacher retained. They could have sent it back to the ALJ.
They would have had the authority to send it back. My position is that would have been erroneous as a matter of law, but they would have had the authority to send it back. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you.
Appreciate the court having asked me some questions, because I didn't have half an hour's worth of prepared argument. And that's really all I have to say for my opening argument.
Thank you. Counsel?
Morning, Your Honor. Bryn Case and Holly Ortiz is with me, representing the appellees, Denver Public Schools and its Board of Education. First and foremost, and I'm not trying to get back to the facts, but I do want it made clear that in the hearing, in the full hearing in this case, that the hearing officer was hyper-vigilant to ensure that the only facts that came before him were those alleged in the most recent recommendation. So it's important to recognize that nothing from the March 2001 recommendation came into evidence at that hearing. And that's undisputed in this case. If the counsel for Mr. Hansen wanted to say that the counsel for Mr. Hansen is not arguing that the ALJ erred in allowing evidence from the first recommendation into the second proceeding. That's not being argued in this case. What we have in this case is a decision based solely on the November 2011 recommendations, solely on the facts therein, and then went to the board. It's important to recognize that we're not in a civil litigation here. And this is something that I think Judge Navarro was picking up on in one of his questions to Mr. Kaiser. He asked if there are any cases saying that the doctrine of claim preclusion applies in the context of a statutory or other kind of procedure where you get a recommendation and then take it to a board or other entity for them to make the final decision. And the answer is not only that there aren't any cases that say that, but in fact the case law says that that doctrine does not apply in the teacher dismissal context. The case Mr. Kaiser cited in his brief, Umberfield, there are two other published decisions saying that the doctrine of claim preclusion should not apply in this context because of the peculiar arrangement that the neutral is not the one who makes the final decision. So in the teacher dismissal context, as we know, we get a recommendation from the administration that is provided to a hearing officer, which could be an ALJ or another hearing officer agreed on by the parties. who is supposed to find the facts, find to determine whether the allegations in the recommendation are true or false, essentially, and then send it to back to the district for a final decision. City of Colorado Springs, 749 P. 2nd, 412, clarifies that another case cited in our brief, Moffitt County School District, overruled Umberfield and makes clear that res judicata should not apply in the teacher dismissal context. And that case points out that it's because of exactly that, that the final decision maker is not a neutral. It's the board. So you can't apply it in that context. I'll come back to that later. But
Council, was that case cited in your brief?
The Moffitt County was, which Moffitt County holds the same thing. The case that I just gave you, it clarifies in a footnote that Moffitt County overturned Umberfield. So that's why I gave you the cite, Your Honor, because City of Colorado Springs was not in my brief. But in any event, what we have here is a teacher who was dismissed after a decision based solely on the November of 2011 recommendation. And although there was a little bit of colloquy on this in Mr. Hansen's argument, it is not being argued that the facts that the ALJ found in the second proceeding were insufficient to constitute dismissal.
Right, it's an all or nothing proposition. If we agree with him on claim preclusion, the second ALJ's decision doesn't matter, correct?
I suppose the if A though, you know, it's my position that you cannot agree with him on claim preclusion,
right.
But because the concept just doesn't make any sense. In any, let me, I know the court is probably interested. I think it's the most interesting issue in this case. Fast forward to what I was going to say about collateral estoppel. I mean, first of all, there's really no case law even saying that the doctrine of collateral estoppel should apply in a paradigm like this, or any other similar fact-finding process where a neutral finds the facts and then passes them on to the employer for making the ultimate decision. This is really for policy reasons. The way this works, if a hearing officer finds a fact that merits dismissal, and the board and finds that fact and returns it to the board, and the board reviews that and decides to give the teacher another chance, says this could constitute dismissal under the law, but we're going to reinstate the teacher. So they reinstate the teacher, put him or her back in the classroom, and the teacher does the same thing yet again. The district administration recommends dismissal, goes back before a fact finder. Could the board not consider the first misdeed simply because the hearing officer in the first case found that it had occurred, and then the board in making its decision on the decision decided to retain the teacher? I mean, that policy just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's wrong for not only us, but it's also wrong for the teacher. Because, first of all, from our point of view, it would preclude the board from weighing the commission of a repeated wrong. For example, you know, you've done something once. Well, you know, we could have fired you for that, but we're not going to. We're going to give you another chance. And you put them right back, and they do it again. Applying that doctrine would perhaps, it's not even clear how that would work, but I think if you adopt that argument, that would mean that, hey, you can't dismiss the teacher based on that, because collateral estoppel.
But you wouldn't be dismissing the teacher based solely on that. You'd have a second offense, so to speak, wouldn't you?
Correct, and that's exactly what we have in this case, Your Honor.
So the issue of whether a particular act was sufficient to justify dismissal may have been decided, but that doesn't mean that the board was bound to agree with dismissal being the remedy. But if the second go around, the teacher does exactly the same thing with a different student, perhaps, it certainly couldn't have been brought up the first time because it didn't exist. The second time is a brand new dismissal proceeding, don't you agree?
I agree, but the fact of the matter is that the first time still happened, and it certainly can be considered. I mean, we're not in a situation here where the board would just be coming back and looking and deciding for a second time whether it was going to dismiss the teacher solely on allegations found in the first case. And the court has latitude here. I mean, let's remember the standard of review in this case, that what the what this court is supposed to do is determine whether the board's action was arbitrary or capricious or legally impermissible. We're getting to the legally impermissible piece of it when we talk about res judicata and collateral estoppel, neither of which the district submits should apply in this instance. But what the court could really look at, and something that was addressed in the teacher's brief, is this whole concept of what the district was doing was judge shopping, or finding for us would allow the school district to judge shop. That's simply, I mean, I know the court knows the facts, that's simply not what happened in this case. The bottom line is that if the school district took a case to hearing based on factual scenario A, got a decision back from the ALJ and said, we don't like this decision, we're gonna roll the dice with a new ALJ. And we returned it back to the Office of Administrative Courts, got a different ALJ and got a better decision, decided to go with the second one. The court could find that was an arbitrary and capricious action of the board. Arbitrary and capricious, I view that standard as meaning, you know, lacking legal justification. There was no other basis for it besides the fact that they were judge shopping.
What is the legal justification that you have for the board not making a decision on the first ALJ recommendation?
Two cases, Your Honor, both appear in our brief. One is Snyder, the other is Dugan. Both cases were similar sort of cases. There are some differences, but what happened in those cases is that the school district commenced a dismissal process with a teacher and then stopped that process because of some error in it and started over. And the teacher, in both cases, contended that once you've started this process, you can't stop it, and you can't cure any deficiencies with it by simply just starting over.
Does it make any difference, Mr. Case, based upon when the issue arose? Because the issue arose here on the morning of the hearing. The issue in those cases arose well before the hearing. Did it not?
The answer to that is either yes or you can't tell from the decisions. But let's assume that, let's narrow in on that. Here, and there were some questions about this earlier. I mean, the evidence that was in the record was that the only evidence in the record on this point is that the facts in the case were recently discovered, and there's no other. Granted, they occurred during or before the time frame of the allegations in the previous set of charges, but the only thing that we have in the record, the undisputed evidence in the record is that the district administration, the people putting together the case, found out about it shortly before the hearing, and they moved the hearing officer for permission to cure this defect by giving Mr. Hansen notice of the charges, notice of what they would actually be presenting to the hearing officer to make findings of fact thereon. And what the hearing officer did, in essence, is to say, no, you know, you can't do that. The result of that is that the district was then attempting to dismiss a teacher based in part on charges of which it had not yet given Mr. Hansen notice. The statute doesn't allow that. So having found that the district didn't follow the statute with regard to those new charges, the district withdrew the proceedings.
Well, you got a decision from the ALJ, did you not, saying you can't do that?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Yeah, so you're saying the proceeding was void, the ALJ said it was not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so why does the district get to make that decision as opposed to the ALJ?
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ only has authority to do what the statute says. And what the ALJ has authority to do, as the statute reads, is take a recommendation and make findings of fact thereon. And so our case doesn't hinge on this argument because of what the judge actually did. The judge...
But in your theory, the ALJ had the authority to dismiss the case without prejudice, as you asked, correct? I mean, you asked the ALJ to do that, didn't you?
Yes, that's in the...
So you agree that ALJ had the authority to dismiss the case, so you think he would have also the authority to not dismiss the case and compel it to go forward, as it did?
Well, Your Honor, I think the position that we take on that is that on the issue of dismissing the case or continuing the proceedings, that the district is in the driver's seat. The district is paying for the proceeding, and the statute requires the district to take this to somebody to make facts on a particular set of allegations. And so if the district says, we don't want you to make, we're stopping the proceeding, and we no longer are asking you to make facts on these particular allegations, then our position is the ALJ should have done that.
But your position is ALJ had to do that. Had ALJ had no authority to allow the proceedings to continue as he did?
I think that's the decision. I mean, it's a more difficult issue that I think the case doesn't hinge on, considering that there's no such thing as claim preclusion and res judicata in this context. And the effect was that although the district tried to introduce allegations from the March 2011 recommendation, it was completely foreclosed from doing so, and there's no dispute about that.
But as a factual matter, you rely on, I think, the Dugan case and the Snyder case, and those scenarios, weren't the original proceedings actually dismissed by the hearing officer as opposed to your case?
I don't read the cases like that, Your Honor. Admittedly, the cases don't say much about it. I think that in Snyder and Dugan are a bit different in that regard. In Snyder, the first case, I believe the facts of that case were the superintendent just sent a letter to the teacher saying you're terminated. And then at some later point after that, the superintendent in the district, I think, recognized that you can't do that. You have to give the teacher notice of the charges and a hearing thereon, and then you can dismiss the teacher. Dugan is a little bit different, because Dugan says is that the school district commenced proceedings under the Teacher Dismissal Act in effect at that time. How far those proceedings, we don't know. I mean, my reading of the case is that it was relatively early on. And the statute was different at that time. I don't cite that case for the proposition that the parties had gone up in front of a hearing officer and they dismissed the proceedings on the day the hearing was supposed to begin. We don't know.
But the quotation you have of Dugan is the first original proceeding, or the first proceeding was dismissed.
It does say that, and I was looking at the case just recently, there's also an issue that the teacher made in his reply brief, that it says the case was dismissed upon agreement of the parties, which is something that could perhaps be argued. But the point is that the teacher in that case, and I think the court assumed that it doesn't make any difference how it was dismissed. I mean, by not saying that decision didn't say, well, wait, it was because the dismissal was by agreement of the parties that we're not going to say that it barred the future dismissal. It doesn't say that. All it says is that when a first proceeding is dismissed and is void, is a nullity, then you can have the second proceeding, and the dismissal of the first proceeding doesn't affect the second. Something else that's important that I want to point out about those two cases is that in both of them, exactly like this case, the teacher does not argue that the hearing and the facts upon which he or she was actually dismissed were not sufficient for dismissal. This case is exactly like those two cases in that regard, that the facts that were eventually found in a hearing where there was no dispute about whether the teacher had proper notice or whether the hearing was properly conducted, whether what came out of that proceeding wasn't sufficient for dismissal. So the case...
Excuse me, Mr. Case. Is there anything in the record that indicates that these new allegations that surfaced at the October 2011 hearing, is there any evidence that those could not have been discovered with the exercise of reasonable diligence in advance of that date?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any evidence in the record in that regard at all.
And it's your position that that's not relevant?
Well, I think it's relevant. I think the parties have kind of disputing positions, or the positions really are completely in opposite of each other, because my position on that is that the only thing in the record is that the these were recently discovered. And while there is certainly argument and allegations that the district with reasonable diligence could have found this stuff out before, that's all there is. There's nothing in the record to suggest that. There's no finding by the the hearing officer or anything like that. All we have is the single piece of evidence that we have on that point is undisputed, and there's simply no evidence of what you're saying. There's,
well, whose burden is it? Isn't that, wouldn't that be the burden of the proponent of the new allegations?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think we're talking about a scenario in which the doctrines of claim preclusion and or collateral estoppel apply, which I disagree with, first of all. But there, I think that the proponent of that defense, so to speak, the burden would be on that person to show that. I mean, this isn't, we have to keep in mind that this is not a, this is a statutory procedure that's quite distinct from regular civil litigation, of which we're all used to. I mean, it's not a scenario in which the court has to figure out whether they're doing this with prejudice or without prejudice, simply because that concept just doesn't really enter into the picture.
Well, I mean, so you have the new proceeding that started in November, and then that was, a hearing was in March,
correct,
approximately. So at that time, the district could have shown up and said, well, we've got some more allegations we want to raise. And of course, the teacher hasn't been working through all this time, so they're all ones to relate to when he was teaching. And at that point, the ALJ, on your approach, seems to have no choice but to say, we'll go ahead and hear it, or we'll give you another continuance.
Well,
the ALJ has no ability to control the proceedings, is what I'm kind of hearing you say.
No, I think I disagree with that a bit, Your Honor, as far as what you just, the last thing you said, that the ALJ has no ability to control the proceedings. On this point, but on the point that you're asking me to submit to, I think the answer to that is yes, that if the whole thing happened again, then there wouldn't be anything different about what I'm saying. But that leads me to an important factual point that no one has discussed yet here today, is the fact that after the proceedings from the March 2011 recommendation were discontinued, the record is clear on the fact that the teacher received full back pay. Now, so the problem from the school district's point of view to the scenario that you just gave, Judge Miller, is that it would be obligated to reimburse the teacher for, we'd have to pay the teacher for all this time out. True, while they may not be working, what the other provisions of the Teacher Employment Compensation and Dismissal Act are going to require that the teacher be repaid. So if the school district takes a position that they want to keep a teacher out indefinitely, unless there is some other provision of the law that says they'd have to stop paying them, then we have to continue paying them. So it's while that example you gave, it does seem to stretch the credulity of my argument a bit. However, that's not really practical, given the fact that it would require the school district to continue paying somebody just to stay out and do nothing. So that's not going to happen. The other thing here, it goes back to what I said a moment ago, that this panel has the authority to determine whether the board's actions were arbitrary and capricious. So if if...
But I think the second proceeding is not the focus of our discussion here. The focus of our discussion is whether the first proceeding can have preclusive effect on the second. It's, I don't think anybody, I don't think the teacher is even asserting that the facts adduced in the second hearing are at issue in the case. He's taken, as I understand it, an all-or-nothing approach. If I win on claim preclusion, the second proceeding is a nullity. Do you agree with that?
I suppose I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, let me ask you some questions about claim preclusion issues, because the finality prong depends upon whether there is a final order, correct?
Yes.
All right. The district and the board had complete control over whether there would be a final order, correct?
I think the answer to that question is yes, Your Honor. Except I'm resistant to equate what happens in the teacher dismissal statutory process with the final order that's contemplated by the doctrines of res judicata and collateral estoppel, simply because our binding precedent has recognized that the concept of res judicata, at least, does not apply.
Well, let's assume it does apply, just for purposes of discussion. And I understand your argument that it does not. If it does apply, why is there not practical finality, given that the board had complete control over whether it issued a final order? What more could the teacher do? He couldn't do anything except proceed with a mandamus action saying to the board, issue your final order, whatever it is. Give me a final order. And he never got it.
And so he remained employed, is the point.
But that's collateral, I think, to the issue. The issue is, do you have preclusive effect based on finality? Because the teacher could do nothing more. He asked the district court for mandamus. He didn't get it. He said to the board, give me a final order. He didn't get it. Mm-hmm. What more could he be asked to do to get a final order that he could then assert was preclusive?
Well, Your Honor, I think to make this easier for the court to decide, I'm not arguing that there was no practical finality. I'm not arguing that if we were in a world where the doctrine of res judicata applied, it makes sense what the other side is saying.
To be clear, I mean, the discussion in the brief suggested that the doctrine of practical finality has not been applied to claim preclusion up to this point, but you are conceding that it does apply to the doctrine of claim preclusion?
Well, I am having difficulty answering Judge Casebolt's question about what more the teacher could do. But let me propose this, is that keep in mind that this case does not come to this court unless the teacher gets dismissed. And I think that the reason why these cases were decided correctly here is because the teacher has the opportunity to file an appeal with the Court of Appeals in the event that he is dismissed. If you read the statute, there's no opportunity for the district to come and file an appeal with the Court of Appeals if the teacher's retained. So I think a question that I'm not sure was clearly answered was, well, what is the district supposed to, can the district appeal? The idea here is that I know Mr. Kaiser mentioned the possibility of remand, but I think, so what could have happened is that if the board looked at that decision, it could have remanded to a hearing officer who had already said he's not going to find facts based on what happened in that proceeding. And then what?
Just to be clear, you think the board did, if for example, in your scenario, you obviously disagreed with the ALJ's decision not to dismiss the earlier March charges, and you disagree with the decision of the ALJ to go forward and issue a recommendation, but the ALJ did so anyway. You could have taken that to the board, asking the board to disagree with the ALJ's procedural ruling, and the board could have sent it back to the hearing officer under your view?
Yeah, I think Mr. Kaiser is right that the board does have the authority to remand a case to a hearing officer for additional findings of fact.
And this is under some theory of inherent authorities? I mean, I didn't see it in the statute, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just wondering from where it comes.
It comes from the courts. As I understand it, there's case law authorizing the school board to do that, although it's not specifically mentioned in the statute.
So why didn't you take that course in this case?
Well, Your Honor, the district's position was that it had withdrawn those charges, that there was no more dismissal proceeding. It had reimbursed the teacher fully and brought a new dismissal proceeding. That's why the district did what it did in this instance.
So I know we keep trying to simplify things in a way you aren't necessarily comfortable with, so I apologize, but the case seems to turn on, from your perspective, this case law, the Colorado Springs case, the Moffitt County case, as to whether or not the doctrine of claim preclusion applies in the context where the ALJ's only authority is to make some factual findings and a recommendation. Is that fair?
That particular argument does. Yes, I mean that particular argument. I mean actually, I think I'll agree with you fully, because the what you're saying is that the teacher's best argument here is that by not bringing the allegations in the second recommendation in the first hearing, that the district waived the right to forever waive the right to bring those. I mean, that's the teacher's argument. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that under this statutory procedure, where you have a neutral who's supposed to find facts and then return those facts to the hearing officer, or excuse me, to the board, that concept just doesn't hold water in this instance. That and in any event, what had happened here, I mean, I think that the point is that at best you're talking about collateral estoppel, which I don't think should apply in the first place. But even if it did, that's what the ALJ did, I think. He essentially said, I have already determined the issue of whether or not the allegations in the first set of charges were true, and I found that they did not. So I'm not going to let you bring those in the second proceeding. I'm not going to make any findings of fact for the board to dismiss the teacher on based on the first recommendation. And he only went with the second, and that's very clear. And I think it's an easy way for this panel to decide the case, since it's inarguable that the findings of fact in the second decision constituted a sufficient basis for dismissal. Your Honor, with that, unless there are any more questions, I see my time is expiring.
Thank you. Mr. Kaiser, you have some time remaining for rebuttal.
I do, Your Honor, just a little bit. I guess I'm kind of struggling with counsel coming up here and saying that there can't be claim preclusion in a teacher dismissal case. Obviously, City of Colorado Springs case is not one that I'm familiar with, since they didn't cite it in their briefs. But turning to their answer brief, they do cite the Moffitt County case, but they don't cite it for that proposition. The answer brief says it is true that, quote, findings and conclusions of an administrative agency may be binding upon the parties in a subsequent proceeding if the agency rendered the decision acting in judicial capacity, et cetera, et cetera. They certainly don't argue in the answer brief that there can't be res judicata in the teacher dismissal case. And I would submit that that's not an argument that in the long term is really going to help the school district. I mean, if there can't be, I'm assuming if there can't be claim preclusion, there can't be issue preclusion. So if a teacher has a hearing in front of an administrative law judge, they get a full and fair hearing, the judge makes some adverse factual findings, then the teacher brings some sort of separate action in district court, I'm guessing that in that case, the school district's going to be arguing that there can be claim issue preclusion probably in that situation. And just by the caption of the Moffitt County case, Industrial Commission versus Moffitt County, and I'm vaguely remembering, I think, my recollection, and the court can pull the case itself to address what seems to be a new argument by the district. I'm guessing, or I'm vaguely remembering, that that's a unemployment case. And my recollection is that Moffitt County held that there can't be if you lose a teacher dismissal hearing,
you're not barred from trying to get your unemployment. And my recollection is the case law on unemployment is that it's sui generis, that there are just some things in the unemployment statute that are different from the issues in the teacher dismissal case. The only other point, and I'm just not familiar at all with the City of Colorado Springs case, I'm apparent for the first time in this context today, but the court can look those up itself. The other thing I'm going to say is just keeping the teacher on leave and paying the teacher, it's not like really a paid vacation. My teachers struggle in that situation. You're sitting around, your career's at stake, you can't really do anything, and you know, the fact that somebody's on pay doesn't cure the defects that we would submit to the court exist in this case.
Question for you, Mr. Kaiser. In light of the fact that City of Colorado Springs case wasn't cited either in the briefs or before today, we would ordinarily give you an opportunity to file a supplemental response simply to that case alone within 5 days. Do you want to take advantage of that, or do you decline to do so?
I mean, you know, I'd like the opportunity to take advantage of it. I'll go back to my office and read the case if I have something to say about the case. But I've got 749 P second 412, is that correct? I can look it up.
All right. What you should do is you should put it in a letter form directed to the three of us individually as opposed to the clerk. Make sure a copy goes to Mr. Case so that it's not ex parte in any way. And limit your response to about 3 pages devoted only to that case and how it would affect the case before us.
If I can just have a second to write a note, I'll let it go to the court. All right, thank the court for its time and attention.
Can I have one more question? I'm sorry. As I understand the record, the only reason the ALJ gave for not endorsing your claim preclusion theory was that the order was not final. The earlier March, the order as to the March meeting was not final.
That's right.
And that's why you're relying on this practical finality theory here, correct?
Well, actually, Your Honor, my first request to the ALJ was that the ALJ stay the case.
No, but I've asked you your claim preclusion theory. The only reason the ALJ gave for not adopting that theory was that the earlier decision was not final.
Yes.
So if we agreed with you in the mandamus case, and that case ultimately resulted in a mandamus to the board to issue an order as to the March recommendation, you would have the final order. And then the only reason the ALJ gave for not applying claim preclusion would be gone. In that scenario, do you think we should wait rather than decide your claim preclusion question now? Should we wait to have the mandamus proceedings run their course, which may moot the question of whether practical finality can apply in this scenario?
Your Honor, given the posture of the case, I mean, at this point, I don't see what good a remand to the board's going to do to decide the first case. I mean, they're either going to retain Mr. Hanson, which I guess they might do, so I can't totally rule it out if that's what the court wants to do, or dismiss him. I mean, the more likely I would submit, given the way the world works, is what the board's going to do is send the case back to the ALJ saying you were wrong, in which case we still can't come to this court. We really can't do anything. Maybe do a mandamus at that point.
But in that scenario, the ALJ might agree with your claim preclusion case because the only obstacle to it has been removed.
Well, depending on what the board does. I mean, the board issues a final decision. I mean, if the board issues a final decision, if just trying to walk it backwards. Let's just say the district court agreed with me and ordered the board to rule before the ALJ issued the second decision, okay? So it goes back to the board. The board can do a couple of things. Board can remand the case to the ALJ and say you were mistaken when you denied the motion to dismiss without prejudice or amend the charges, therefore start over. That would have been one possibility, or I guess that's one possibility. Now, the second possibility is the board says, we agree with the ALJ and the district didn't prove its case, therefore we're retaining Mr. Hanson, probably on probation, that's usually what they do. That's a less likely scenario. The third scenario is that they just dismiss Mr. Hanson, which would be an absurd ruling if the board's considering the first case, because the judge said they didn't put on any evidence. So I think that's unlikely. So it's unlikely if that happens, we're going to be able to come back to this court anytime soon. We'll be back in the administrative proceedings. I don't know how that's going to work. So I'm sorry to give you a long-winded answer on it.
That's okay.
It's a tough question.
Thank you.
Mr. Kaiser, let me ask you this. The district court didn't actually rule on your petition for mandamus.
That's correct.
Do we have authority to do that, or do we have to remand to the district court to consider that?
You don't have authority to rule on mandamus. All you can do is remand to the district court with directions, which the district court will follow, of course.
But we can't direct the district court to issue a mandamus?
Oh, you can. Yes, you can direct the district court to issue a mandamus.
But the problem I'm having is that issue is not really squarely before us, is it? The issues before us are the whether there's subject matter jurisdiction, whether he erred in saying that you had to exhaust administrative remedies. So my problem is we don't have an order to even review for purposes of mandamus. We just have some decisions that the court made that we have authority to review and reverse if we think it's appropriate. But I'm struggling with whether we have authority ourselves to require the board to issue a final order.
No, this court does not have authority to order the board to issue a final order. I mean, that's clear to me, Your Honor. I mean, the court's going to write its opinion how it's going to write it, and the court can give the district court some direction or ideas, but, you know, only the district court can issue the mandamus. I'm not disputing that. This court has authority to reverse the board on judicial review. This court doesn't have authority to issue mandamus, only the district court does. I agree with you there.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. We will await the submission from Mr. Kaiser if he chooses to do so. But the case stands at issue. We'll issue a written opinion in due course.